Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keynote, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It's June 6th, New Book Day, Tuesday, 2023. And we're having a new Russia Fiction and Fact Book Day. Earlier today, I talked with Paul Goldberg, who has a new novel out, the so-called Crime and Punishment for the Jews, a book called The Dissident, which is very much built on a real story in 1976 of a visit to Moscow by the then Secretary of State, a certain Heinz Alfred Kissinger, otherwise known as Henry Kissinger, had Paul Goldberg on the show. Henry Kissinger, who was 100 earlier this month, wasn't available. But today we're reversing things. There's another book out about another real event in Russian history. It's by an author called Josh Haven. It's called The Siberia Job. It's a book in fictional terms about a Texan businessman called John Mills, who in 1994 was sick of London, sick of banking, and homesick for Texas. So he abruptly quits his job with an investment bank, buys a plane ticket to Dallas, but a chance encounter with a slick check turns his life upside down and takes him on a wild and sometimes scary escapade to Siberia. As it happens, the real edition, the real version of that man is my guest today on the show. He is the fact figure at the heart of the Siberia Job fiction. His name, as it happens, I don't think he's related to Henry Kissinger, is John Kleinhans, and he is a big-time financial guy, very much involved with Stanford University, the CEO of Kleinhans Capital Partners, and he's joining us today. John, history works in ironic ways, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
So tell me a little bit more about yourself. You're a rather, I'm going to say shady guy, but it's hard to figure stuff out about you. I went to Kleinhans Capital Partners and I didn't get a lot of information, John. Tell me about you and your career. It's quite unusual.
Well, I haven't had a high profile in my career. I went into the hedge fund business in 1993 as a junior partner, where I ran the Russia fund with another fellow from Texas. In 96, I went out on my own and started my own fund. We had a lot of success. We started with $1 million, and I think, we peaked at well over 4 billion. We had very good returns, and in 2000
to put that mildly, John, to take an investment of what, a million, and turn it into 4 billion. How do you do that?
Well, I mean, that's not the way the math works. I mean, we had investors that came in along the way. I think we raised a net of $700 or $800 million. So, it wasn't all gains, but a lot of it was. The hedge fund business changed a lot. I was one of the early people there. And in 2014, I decided to give all the money back to my investors. And I still run a hedge fund. I still run Kleinhans Capital, but it's a family office now.
Right. So as I found from Reuters, you decided to liquidate, although I'm guessing it was because you'd made so much money, you could return the investment. Is that right?
In part, we did well, but it was also just it was difficult running the business. It was becoming more institutionalized. Investors were kind of coming in and out, and I was losing capital at precisely the time I needed it most. And it just wasn't a good business model for me. And I enjoy investing, but having a lot of investors complicated my life. So I did what a lot of managers do. I formed a family office.
So how much of this fictional John Mills, this businessman, this invention in 1994, Josh Haven's invention, how much of it is based on your real life?
You know, it's largely based on my life. I would say the storyline in this book, which is true, the plot and the story are true. But there were, you know, there were hundreds of characters involved in this particular investment strategy, and a lot of the characters are compilations. I mean, I'm a number of the stories that involve me and involve my former partner and other people as well. But it's largely based on my life and my experience and what I did in Russia.
And this is in part your project. You came up with the idea of the Siberia job, and then you found a writer. Is that fair, Josh?
That's correct.
Why didn't you write it yourself, John? You're a Stanford boy. You're smart. You could have written it.
Yeah, you know, I can write a pretty mean business memo, but you know, I wanted to write a story that would sell books and would be entertaining. And you know, I know what my strengths are, and I'm not, you know, I'm not a writer. You know, most people in my position hire ghostwriters, so there's nothing unusual about the way I approach
it. And why make it a novel? Bill Browder, I think, has blurbed your book. He's become very well known. He, like you, was a former investor in America, in Russia, who made a lot of money, politically very controversial, maybe more visible than you, but he's mostly written nonfiction. Why not just write your memoir?
You know, Bill's a very good friend of mine. I knew Bill. Bill and I were both bankers in London before the Berlin Wall fell. We were both early in Russia, and Bill and I did a lot of business together. And I think the Red Notice book is a tremendous book. It's nonfiction, as you pointed out. It reads well. It's got a great storyline. It's tragic. It's insightful. It's great. It's all around a great book. I think Bill sold 3 million copies of the book. The problem is I started this. I've been out of Russia more or less since the early 2000s. And for me to go back and write a nonfiction book would have been really difficult. I mean, I've I can't remember all the people that were involved. I can't fact check. If you try to write this story in a factual way, it might not capture the reader's attention. The details are such that it wouldn't necessarily be all that interesting. What I think Josh Haven did, or Josh Gelertner, which is Josh's real name, he interviewed a lot of the people that were involved in this project, this investment project. We did, and he got stories out of them, and interesting stories, and he weaved them all together, but he still followed our original plot line, and in that way he made it a really readable and enjoyable book. And in fact, if we have time at the end of this, I'd love to tell you a story about the Refuseniks, because in our research we heard a wonderful,
right. Are you familiar with Goldberg's book, The Dissident?
I'm not, but I'm familiar with the Refuseniks and what the Russian intelligence community did to them on the way out of Russia, and I've got a good story if we have time.
Okay, well I've always got time, John, especially for good stories. You wrote a piece for Fortune recently, actually, from the last day of May this year. And the title, I Got Rich in Russia and Got Out in Time Twice. Here's what I learned about democracy and free markets. It's not a very Klein-Heinzian title. You're not the kind of guy to shout from rooftops about yourself. Tell me how you got rich in Russia. What is the story?
So first of all, that I did write that essay, and Fortune edited it a bit, but they only insisted that they could pick the title. So that's not my title.
I didn't think it would be. I don't think that's the kind of title you would personally choose, but that's what happens when you dine with the devil. How did you get rich? So you were a youngish man who saw a business opportunity. I mean, how much of the Siberia job is true? Did you just bump into a charming Czech businessman?
No, I was introduced to him. That I did not meet Peter in a bar. That's a fictional part of the book. But I was introduced to him by a colleague from Merrill Lynch, and was told that he had been very successful in the Czech voucher auctions, and he knew what he was doing, and he was setting up in Russia, and I should work with him. You know, we all got to Russia in 94. I actually went in 92 with my wife and spent a couple weeks there. And what I saw in 92 was really disheartening. The economy was really at a standstill. The command economy was no longer functioning. The currency didn't work. They were paying workers with money that was worthless. They were making products that weren't any good. People were walking around Moscow with their heads down. There were no goods in the shops. There were no cars on the streets. And when I returned again in early 1994, it was a different place. It was everybody was busy. You could get anything you wanted if you had the money. What had functionally been the black market 2 or 3 years earlier was emerging as a free market system. There was a sense of excitement in the air, and it was all kind of aimed at this privatization that was going to take place. The Russians were going to privatize all of their businesses, all of their state-owned businesses over the course of 1 year, 1994. And these businesses were privatized at literally 1 to 2% of the value of where the stocks would be trading if they were on a Western exchange, Western European exchange, or in the US. And so we were able to buy stocks so incredibly cheaply. We bought a company called Lukoil at a $300 million valuation. That stock, just before Russia invaded Ukraine, that stock was trading at a $60 billion valuation. So
why wasn't Moscow in 1994 crawling with young investment bankers like yourself?
It was. They were coming in. I got there early. I got there 3 or 4 months early. I was ahead of the game. But by late 1994, Merrill Lynch was setting up an office. Morgan Stanley was setting up an office. Citibank had moved in. It was a very exciting place. There were new restaurants opening every week, new hotels. In a lot of ways, Russia in 94 and 95 felt like the center of the universe to me.
John, lots of interpretations of what happened in this period. I did a show recently last year, actually, with Catherine Belton. I'm sure you're all too familiar with her book, Putin's People.
Yep. I know it well.
I'm sure you know Catherine. To what extent would it be fair to say that this was essentially what some people might even suggest was the economic rape of the country by not just Russian oligarchs like Abramovich, but also foreign investors like yourself?
Well, it was a little bit different in 1994. I mean, none of these companies had any working capital. They couldn't turn their factories on. Boris Yeltsin was in office. He had a very strong political appointment or political opponent named Zhuganov, I believe his name was.
A nostalgist for the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and I think the brilliant thing that the Russians did, and was I think it was the architect of it all, was a guy named Anatoly Chubais. He was the architecture of this privatization scheme. He just realized that if you privatized all of these companies, it would be very difficult for Russia to go back to a communist system. I think that was why they did it. They didn't really have the choice. China took a long time to privatize itself. They built their companies up and restructured them and got very good prices for them when they sold. I don't think Russia had that luxury. The economy wasn't in a functional state.
But how fair was it, what Chubais and others planned? I mean, did it essentially mean that ultimately all the and the Russian economy is mostly built on its assets, its gold, its oil? How much of this was essentially the reallocation, redistribution of Russian wealth from the state to private banks?
Well, it's a little bit complicated. I mean, in the privatizations, they did privatize all of it. I mean, the government maintained a controlling stake in Gazprom and a very large stake in all the rest of the oil companies. So really, they were just creating a market for the shares that the companies could go out and raise money. The real transfer of wealth from the government to the oligarchs took place 4 or 5 years later, after Yeltsin resigned and Putin took over. And that was what they call the loans for shares scheme. And that was the real transfer mechanism of putting all the assets into the oligarchs' hands. And that happened much later than this book. So we were just there for the beginning of the stock market, a lot of foreign investors. The Russians kind of pretty much came in after us and pushed most of us out.
How much association did you have with Yeltsin and his regime, the people around him?
I had no connection with them at all. I mean, they had a whole host of problems they were dealing with. My play here was just to, my great hope was that the process would work for a few years. When you buy an asset that's trading at a 99% discount, and all of a sudden they publish an annual report and there's some research on the company and it gets listed, it can trade at an 80% discount. And when something goes from a 99% discount to an 80% discount, you've made 19 or 20 times your money already. So I was just hoping the process could move forward a bit, and it did. It moved forward,
John, should we and do you look back at this period between, say, around 94 and the late 90s with a degree of nostalgia, in the same way some historians look back at the period between the first and second Russian revolutions, the revolution of March and of November, as a period where Russia was relatively free and open?
I wouldn't call it nostalgia, Andrew. It's almost a sense of disappointment because things were going so well, and the process of moving to a free market system really was progressing well. The Russians were playing the game. They understood the stock market. They liked the stock market. They liked the liquidity it gave them. What really happened is in 1998, Russia went through a financial crisis, and it's a financial crisis that started in Asia and moved to Russia. And the IMF went in and they bailed out Russia. They gave them a package. And early on in that process, in October of 98, Bob Rubin, who was Treasury Secretary under Clinton, he got reports that IMF bailout money was ending up in Switzerland and it was ending up in the bank accounts of Russian government officials. And he literally the next day turned the money off to Russia and all their banks collapsed. They had a major crisis. The cash machines didn't work and the country basically defaulted. So, it's disappointing. It was everything in my mind was going pretty well. Up until that. And then, Russia just didn't have the institutions. They didn't have a central bank system where the head of the central bank could tell the Boris Yeltsin people, hey, you can't just take the money out. That wouldn't happen in most places. But it was a new central bank and a new leadership, and that happened.
What is this? We don't want to give away all the plot, John, because we want people to buy the book. But what are the tension, the narrative tension? What happens in the book to excite people, to encourage them to turn the page?
So remember, Russia was auctioning off all of these great companies, and auctions were a number of the best auctions. There was very limited information on them because the more people that knew about the auction, the higher the valuation would be. The more vouchers submitted, the higher the price you would pay. So what Gazprom did, Gazprom was negotiating with Chubais and said, look, we don't want to be in the auctions. And Chubais said, look, I'll let you design your auction the way you want. So it doesn't, all the investors don't go in there and there's nothing left for you guys. And so Gazprom structured the auction where it took place in these remote regions where they had business operations. And they made it very, very difficult for people to get to these places. And they held these auctions without really publicizing when they would be and where they would be. Now we had a very good contact on the board at Gazprom who was feeding us information, and so we were able to send teams of people to these auctions and submit our vouchers, and we did really well. We ended up buying so much stock in the voucher that when the company found out, they were really upset, and the management was upset because they hadn't put as many vouchers in as we had. And so they called the same guy on the board that we knew, who was a former KGB official, and they said, go find out what happened. And so all of a sudden our friend was in a position where he's trying to get our stock back. So it was a very tough set of negotiations. We finally arrived at a deal with Gazprom after a lot of implied threats. We settled up with them. We turned over a very large percentage of our stock, 75-80% of our stock, and in return, they gave us GDRs, which would be freely tradable in the London market. So you know, we did well. We got a security that we were allowed to trade legally. It was registered on the books. We made a lot of money. Where those shares went, nobody knows. It's still a mystery who got our shares, but it was a lot of money. I mean, whoever took the 75% of our stock, you know, did well.
And any guesses, John, who ended up with your stock?
I think it was the Gazprom management is my guess.
And these huge companies were intimately bound up with the state, weren't they? And indeed, the secret services.
That's right. That's right.
So were you in Browder's camp when it comes to this, or Catherine Belton's camp when it comes to interpreting what Belton at least calls KGB capitalism?
Yeah, I mean, that happened. I mean, I've that Putin's People book, I've never read it straight through. I almost use it like a reference book.
Yeah.
It's almost like an encyclopedia of the bad guys. So it's very helpful to me, but I haven't read it. But I know her. You know, her point is that in, you know, after Yeltsin left and Putin took over, that you slowly had a system where the intelligence community or the KGB insinuated themselves into all these businesses.
So these people essentially woke up to the fact that they could muscle in on the money.
That's right. That's right. But a lot of them were already there. I mean, you know, if you look at Lukoil, the largest shareholder at Lukoil, who had the innocuous title of head of investor relations, was a guy named Leonid Fadun, and he was a senior KGB guy who was the number two guy at Lukoil, and you know, now he's a country gentleman living in England. So he was there at the beginning, but yes. The intelligence community woke up and got involved in all of this.
I love the title of the book, John, The Siberia Job. Of course, it reminds me of The Italian Job. The end of The Italian Job leaves us, the movie, of course, with a bus teetering on the edge of a Swiss mountain. But The Siberia Job, I'm guessing, ends with clear winners and losers.
You know, it's all I can say is it's got a happy ending.
Like a massage, John. What happy for who?
I think it was happy for everybody. The Gazprom people got their stock, got a big chunk of their stock back. Peter Kellner made a bunch of money and was able to go back into the Czech Republic and provide working capital. He went on to build a huge industrial empire in the Czech Republic and Russia. And when he died tragically a couple of years ago in this helicopter ski accident, you know, he was, you know, worth well over $10 billion. So,
and it was his death that triggered your commitment to doing this book. Is that fair?
That's right. That's right. I saw the news of his death. I thought to myself, I've been wanting to write this story for 30 years. And, you know, if I don't do it now, there's not going to be anybody left to talk to about how to do this story. So, yes, that was the catalyst.
Since then, you've, you know, well, you became very rich twice, as you say, then you returned all the the Klein Heinz money back to the investors. You've also continued the firm, but you're also closely associated with Stanford University. I think you're something called an overseer at the Hoover Institute. So I'm guessing your politics are relatively conservative if you're involved with the Hoover Institute. How did this experience inform your view of democracy and free markets? The Fortune title, you might not like the "I got rich in Russia and got out in time twice," but I'm guessing that what you learned about democracy and free markets is more palatable for you. What did it teach you, and why did it make you one of the major donors at Hoover and a rather powerful American conservative?
Well, I mean, one of the things, one of the initiatives at Hoover is to support and sustain the important institutions of this country, the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is great because we have a strong executive and a Supreme Court and a judicial review based legal system and a strong central bank and two houses of Congress. When you have those great institutions, you can get in trouble as a country. An economy can get in trouble. I mean, we've had the Depression, we've had the great financial crisis, but you fall back on those institutions, and they eventually kick in, and you return to your path of growth and prosperity. I think what I learned in Russia is that they just didn't have the institutions ready to go when they started moving from a command economy to a free market economy. They didn't have the courts. They didn't have the business courts where, you know, they have plenty of law courts in Russia, but when they make a decision, there's no way to review it or appeal it. And so there's a corruption in the court system. There's a corruption in the way government operates. And when you see this in places like India, when 20 or 25% of the people are corrupt, it incentivizes the next 5% of the people to be corrupt too. Because if the only way you can get ahead is to break the law or do something, nefarious to feed your family, you're going to do it. And we're fortunate in the U.S. that most people obey the law. And it's a very, very small percentage of people who cheat in this country. And so the incentive is to do things the right way. Russia didn't have that. They didn't have the institutions in place to for people to do the right thing. I mean, guys like Anatoly Chubais, he's a Boy Scout. He's a great guy. But he just got run over by all the bad dudes in Russia. He couldn't, you know, when you're the only guy doing things the right way, they're going to take advantage of you.
But why does that make you... a conservative? I mean, nobody would argue against institutions. No one's in favor of corruption.
Why am I a conservative? I mean, you know, I believe in the free market system. I think limited government, free market system, individual liberties, celebrate what we have in common, not celebrate, you know, why we're different. Those are all things that are part of the conservative mantra. I mean, I consider myself a very progressive conservative. I spend a lot of time and money on schools for lower income people and building schools for lower income people. I mean, you know, education is the way I got out of, you know, the middle class home that I grew up in. I mean, if I hadn't gone to Stanford, I would have never had the success I had. And that's all part of education. So, you know, I'm conservative because, you know, the government isn't the answer. You don't want your people to be reliant on government. You want them to be reliant on a vibrant free market system.
John, I'm sure you're familiar with Fiona Hill and her work. She was on the show a couple of years ago, worrying about what she called the increasingly Russian way of life in America, the deindustrialization of much of America. I'm not sure if she's a conservative or not. She worked for Donald Trump for a while and fell out with him. Are you, like Hill and others, concerned with America increasingly becoming like Russia and this incredibly dramatic disparities between the very wealthy and the rest of the country? And the deindustrialization, the disappearance of jobs, what Angus Deaton has also been on the show, won a Nobel Prize, called the deaths of despair in America.
Yeah, I mean there's a lot in that question to unpack. I mean, you know, fortunately we're in a phase right now where we're reshoring or re-onshoring a lot of industrial businesses. I mean, I think I saw a statistic, there's $150 billion a year of capital expenditure in manufacturing and engineering projects going on this year in the U.S. So, you know, a lot of it's in semiconductors, a lot of it's very high-end stuff, but it's also in electric vehicle manufacturing. And, you know, a lot of European companies are moving their operations to the southern part of the U.S. because they can sign 10-year energy agreements. And you know, you can't do that in Europe. I mean, the cost of energy, you know, when Putin went into the Ukraine, went up 400-500%, and it pretty much made almost all industrial businesses in Europe unprofitable. So people are moving to the U.S. right now at the fastest rate. What's my greatest concern is, do we have the human capital here to support that? And you know, we need a immigration bill so that people who come to this country and get PhDs can stay and don't have to go home. They can get a green card. We need the process of bringing in, you know, strong workers from overseas. We need great education to fill the human capital gap.
Well, let's end, John, with that story. But before that, I assume you've got plans to turn this new book, Josh Haven's book, based on your life, The Siberia Job, into a movie. Who's going to play John Kleinheinz? You haven't got Michael Caine now. He's a bit old.
So, I hope it gets made into a movie. I'm not going
to. Who do you want to pay? Who would you like to play a younger version of yourself?
I don't really care. I'm not going to get into the artistic. I've talked to Bill Browder about this. I think Bill retained his artistic rights for the Red Notice, and I think that makes it a lot harder to get a movie made. My view is, you know, sell it to somebody who agrees to make the movie and let them do whatever they want with it. So
would you play yourself, John, if they asked you?
No, I'd be the guy, you know, cleaning out the ashtrays in the Russian hotel.
Yeah. They wish you out. Well, that's a warning for anyone who sees the guy cleaning out the ashtrays in the lobby. He's the guy with the money. He's the guy with the power. Finally, John, wonderful conversation, a fascinating project. And I think everyone should appreciate the fact that you've come public on all this in your own reticent way, even if we can blame some of the editors for Fortune for that rather showy title. But finally, the story you wanted to tell that we can end with.
Oh, about the Refuseniks.
Okay. Yes.
So as your listeners know, the Refuseniks were a group of Jews who wanted to leave, successful Jews who wanted to leave Russia, and they weren't given permission because the security apparatus wanted to make sure that they left with nothing. They wanted to take all the wealth that they had accumulated, and so they would follow them around and keep track of their movements and basically make it so that when they left, all their money stayed in the country. And about one of the wealthiest gentlemen left, and the KGB guy who was responsible bumped into this guy 5 or 6 years later when he came back to Moscow. And the guy was obviously very, very wealthy. And he said, "How did you manage to get all your money out of Russia?" And he said, I had a party one night at my large apartment, and I invited 5 people over from the American Embassy. And I, halfway through the party, I took them into a room, and it was stacked full of $100 bills. And we took all of those $100 bills and we counted them. And then I burned them. I put them all in the fireplace. And apparently there's a rule in the U.S. Treasury system that if you can verify that the money has been destroyed, the U.S. Treasury will reissue it to you. And he got affidavits from all these members of the
That's brilliant.
So, and I can't verify that story, but I believe it to be true.